But it's done, right?
Oh, good.
And they can't read that yet because we're just sending it to a publisher.
Well, we'll watch for it.
I'm glad you mentioned, if I may, the remark you just made, Bert, because I always ask readers, not always, I sometimes ask readers, don't miss the optimism beneath the apparent pessimism.
Yes.
We Americans will be so much better off if we drop the pretenses and assumed burdens of empire, hegemony, global leadership, what have you, and greet the future with imagination, some bravery, some courage, some dexterity to move differently in a different landscape. This is all there for us. I'm not going to sell it as something we're on the way to doing tomorrow.
Yeah.
But we can do this. It is within our grasp.
Yes.
I don't know how we can... we need new leadership to accomplish this. That's not on the horizon. I don't want to mess things up for you, Bert, but I don't think much of our political process, right? We don't even have left anymore the mediating institutions through which we can make our preferences clear, right? But it's there.
It is there.
And I don't think we should... I decline to surrender my optimism. I remember years ago, and I'll be quiet after this, I was interviewing this really wonderful sociologist in India, right? Quite a well-known fellow, Viswanathan, Professor Viswanathan. And I leaned across, we were taking apart India's problems. I leaned across his desk when we were done. I said, listen, Professor, I always end my interviews with this question, are you an optimist or a pessimist? And he said, without hesitating, of course I'm an optimist. Why would I bother with critique otherwise?
Absolutely, indeed. And I remain optimistic as well. So, thank you. Patrick Lawrence, always terrific to have you on this show, Keeping Democracy Alive. Thank you so much. And
you're most welcome, Bert. Nice to talk.
I believe newspapers are great mental shapers. My steel industry is dependent on them, really.
Just you call the news and we'll tell all the news from coast to coast and from border to border.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dot.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got 4 requests for this thing already today. Strutting right with it.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
Welcome to Growing Greener, your guide to environmentally informed gardening. Produced in collaboration with the Berkshire Botanical Garden, this program brings you each week some expert who puts you in touch with a different aspect of gardening and partnership with nature. Our goal is to make your personal landscape healthier, more beautiful, more sustainable, and more fun. This is your host, Tom Christopher, and today we will be talking with Dr. Laura J. Martin of Williams College about her fascinating new book, Wild by Design: The Rise of Ecological Restoration. As a gardener, I was intrigued by Dr. Martin's history of how the healing of our landscapes became a popular movement in our nation, and the prominent, if largely forgotten, role that women played as pioneers. Dr. Martin also traces how the goals of ecological restoration have changed over the years, and how ecological restoration has become a big business. Dr. Martin's prescription is to return leadership to us, the gardeners. Dr. Martin, I want to thank you for your fascinating book, Wild by Design, The Rise of Ecological Restoration. Ecological restoration has become the goal of so many gardeners I know, though they might not call what they do that, but so many of us now are trying to heal our local environment and promote native plants and wildlife, which is essentially what ecological restoration is. It was very interesting to me to read in your book about the evolution of this field and how the understanding of restoration and the processes involved have developed over time.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you for reading. Yeah, so I began this project actually in graduate school when I was an ecologist and also a gardener. And I was really interested in the connections between what I was doing as a gardener and what I was learning about and researching in terms of national and state level environmental management. And environmental managers were talking about forest ecosystems and wetland ecosystems as really different spaces than gardens. But I saw a lot of similarities in what people were doing to try and undo environmental harm in non-garden ecosystems and what gardeners try to do to try and manipulate the species that are in a patch of land and try and promote desired species and beneficial species. And so I really started to think of ecological restoration very broadly as a type of gardening or a type of back and forth and collaboration between people and other species.
Could you tell us a bit about your educational and professional background and how you became involved in this? You're a historian now, but you were in the field for quite a while, weren't you?
Yes. So as I mentioned, I went to graduate school for ecology. I was at Cornell University and lucky to be at a university with so many different people working in environmental fields. And so I started my research in wetlands community ecology. So trying to understand how different wetland plant species coexist with one another. And as I was doing that kind of basic research, I got really interested in how science is applied to policy. And more broadly, kind of the history of ecological management and how it is that ecologists came to have a place at the decision-making table when deciding what different environments, whether owned by NGOs or owned by state governments or the federal government, look like. And so I started to dabble in environmental politics and environmental history. And that's where I really discovered a community of people that were asking questions similar to the ones that I was asking about how ecological science can be applied to management and policy and how management has really changed over time. And so that experience and working with state land managers in New York kind of led me to retrain in history and archival research.
And now you're a professor at Williams College, correct?
I am, yes. I am a professor of environmental studies.
The interest in conservation and the movement that would develop into ecological restoration began, if I read your book correctly, largely with a concern over the loss of more glamorous forms of wildlife, birds, and in particular, bison. And often the principal actors, I mean, this is a bit ironic, were male sportsmen driven by a desire to preserve game animals for hunting, such as bison or ducks. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, a lot of what we would today consider ecological restoration, as you recount and as I talk about in the first two chapters of the book, was really centered on charismatic megafauna, big species that were commercially valuable, and species that were hunted or important to sport. And so the American Bison Society and early kind of fisheries societies were among the first organized groups to pursue ecological restoration. this was before ecology really emerged as a science or as its own kind of concept and discipline. The Society for Ecological Restoration was founded in the United States in 1915, and ecology didn't really become a household word until the 1960s. And so in the first decades of ecological restoration in the United States from 1900 until the 1950s, restoration was really game management. It was thought of as a way of farming or gardening game species like bison, like trout, other kind of commercially valuable species. The way that I argue that restoration kind of becomes ecological is with individuals and societies like the Wildflower Preservation Society beginning at a very, very small scale in the 1920s, 1930s, to think about how to help and restore species that were not commercially or recreationally important. Species like Trillium that people valued for their own sake or for aesthetic reasons. And so scientists and naturalists begin to think about restoring these other types of species, again, at a very small scale, a bit later in the history of ecological restoration. And it's not really until the 1970s with the Endangered Species Act that restoration attention shifts focus to groups of species and endangered and imperiled species kind of as a whole.
But if you want to restore populations of animals, you pretty soon come up against the fact, as any gardener would tell you, that that the base of the food chain is plants. And,
yes.
You know, I guess initially they weren't so worried about whether the plants were native or non-native, but women played a big role in that. And I thought that was very, very interesting. You know, my understanding is that botany was one of the few sciences open to women in the late 19th and early 20th century when the ecological restoration movement was being born. And for instance, you mentioned the Wildflower Preservation Society, and that was founded by a woman who doesn't get nearly enough attention, I don't think. I was a student at the New York Botanical Gardens, so I knew about her, but Elizabeth Britton, who is a co-founder of the New York Botanical Garden and the founder of the Wildflower Preservation Society.
Yes, the Wildflower Preservation Society has largely been forgotten today, but it was hugely influential in the United States, both in popularizing the idea of native species and the need to protect native plant species, and in actually establishing gardens and laboratories to study the propagation and reintroduction of native plant species. And a number of the women scientists that founded the Wildflower Preservation Society went on to have leadership roles in other organizations like the Ecological Society of America.
And Elizabeth Britton, if I'm remembering correctly, was a specialist in mosses.
Yes.
But she was quite a respected scientist. But what was the problem that she was confronting in with the Wildflower Preservation Society that sort of spurred her to found that group?
We don't know exactly how Britton came up with the idea of founding the Wildflower Preservation Society, but we know from her writings around that time that, and this is really interesting, the botanists, not all botanists, but many botanists in the early 20th century believed that the major threat to wildflowers was suburban expansion and people leaving the city, including teachers, and bringing people to sites with interesting wildflowers. Wildflowers were a popular Victorian fashion accessory, you know, into the early 20th century, where people liked to decorate their tables with centerpieces made of rare and unusual native plants, and to decorate their hats and coats with these plants. And so the early Wildflower Preservation Society really targeted women and Anglo-Saxon women who lived in cities in particular, and tried to convince them that if they stopped purchasing wildflowers from wildflower vendors on the street, then these populations would be able to recover. And I document in the book how their strategy kind of changes over time from thinking about the consumption of wildflowers to thinking about setting aside land for the preservation and restoration of wildflowers.
Eloise Butler, Fink founded the first ecologically based botanical garden featuring native plants in the United States. And that was back in 1907.
Yes, it was the first garden that was kind of arranged in the United States that was arranged by ecological associations. So grouping, you know, wetland plants together, upland plants together, et cetera, rather than grouping them by taxonomic or evolutionary relationship, which is what was kind of popular to do with academic and research gardens at the time.
And then there was another female pioneer was Edith Roberts, who not long after that developed what she called an ecological laboratory at Vassar College, starting in, I guess, 1919. These are really pioneers.
Yes, and Roberts was a pioneer as well in the profession of ecology. She was active in the Ecological Society of America, despite a number of men in the organization trying to limit the influence and participation of women at the time. The Vassar Ecological Laboratory was doing experiments reintroducing native plants to degraded environments and seeing which ones persisted. And Roberts co-wrote a book on restoring native plants with a landscape architect at the time, and really argued that she was, you know, pretty much the first person to argue that restoration is a blend of science and art, that it is a design practice where the restorationist decides which plant species are both scientifically appropriate to a landscape and have evolved to be in that landscape, but also which ones look good with each other. And she and Elsa Riemann, the landscape architect, went on to design a number of estate gardens in New York State.
What an amazing piece of foresight. I should mention that Wild by Design is not a feminist history. It just gives credit to female as well as male pioneers, which unfortunately has been all too rare in the past. But I did find this fascinating. Dr. Martin, I need to interrupt our conversation to remind listeners that this is Growing Greener, a weekly program about gardening in partnership with nature, coming to you from the studios of WESU-FM in Middletown, Connecticut. Today we are speaking with Dr. Laura J. Martin about her fascinating new book, Wild by Design: The Rise of Ecological Restoration. One thing that I also was very interested by when reading the book was the way that the understanding of ecological restoration has changed so enormously over the years. You know, from focusing on boosting populations of fish and animals for hunting, it moved on to preserving wilderness and then combating invasive species. You point out that the attitude towards introduced plants has changed markedly from the early days a generation ago to now, and a generation ago when many ecological restorationists wanted to set the clock back to pre-Columbian times. So how has that attitude towards introduced plants evolved?
Yes, this was another thing that really surprised me in writing Wild by Design. Working in ecology in recent years, I assumed that concern about non-native species is something that has existed for decades. And that was just kind of the vibe that I got in working with managers and other scientists. And I was pretty shocked to realize through archival research that neither land managers nor ecologists were particularly concerned with non-native invasive species until the 1980s. There are a few exceptions. The agriculturalists and farmers were certainly concerned about new introduced insect pests and fungal pests. And so there, the USDA did have a branch, you know, a quarantine branch that worked to try and control horticultural and agricultural pests. But if we think about, you know, what we would now call ecosystem pests, the broad category of non-native introduced species, scientists didn't really pay attention to them until the 1980s. And it's not that they didn't exist. Scientists were well aware that introduced species were among all types of ecosystems in the early 20th century. And it's not that the number, you know, the number of introduced species introductions has increased over time, but it's not that the 1980s in particular was a pivot point for that. Species introductions really took off during the Second World War. And so I became really interested in this question of how did attention in restoration turn to exclusively native species in the 1980s? Prior to this, a number of restorationists, including Aldo Leopold, advocated for the use of non-native plant species in order to try and restore particular animal species. And so one hypothesis that I landed on is that during the 1970s, there was a total explosion in the number of land trusts in the United States and other private environmental organizations that were working toward conservation and restoration. And with the passage of the amended Endangered Species Act in 1973, suddenly those organizations and land trusts could no longer work with endangered species without federal permits, which were difficult to get. It was only the federal government that was able to experiment with and manipulate endangered species to try and restore them after that point. And so land trusts, like the Nature Conservancy, were kind of left to figure out what else they could do to help endangered species. And while there were prohibitions at the state and federal level against working with endangered and imperiled species, there weren't prohibitions against killing invasive non-native species. And so this is just one reason that these organizations began to experiment with and work with non-native species that has this strangely bureaucratic reason behind it.
Some of the restorationists got quite dogmatic. I remember going to a meeting for people in horticulture about 20 years ago about invasive species in New England. And there was somebody there from the National Park Service who got up in front of the room and told us all that we needed to eliminate from the New England landscape every plant that had been introduced after 1492. And I just listened to him. And, you know, I grew up in the outdoors, and my heart is certainly with native plants and native wildlife. But I went up to him after the talk and I said, you know, do you really think, I mean, there's been centuries of chopping and changing and cutting down trees and eliminating top predators and introducing new animals and plants. And do you really think we can turn the clock back? Because I don't see how. And he just said, well, we can try. And I've just thought of that as a classic Don Quixote moment.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the amount of resources that have been spent by the National Park Service, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and other agencies to try and turn back the clock is staggering. And some efforts have been successful, but many haven't. And so I think more recently, land managers and ecologists, you know, just within the past decade are starting to question that dogmatic approach to invasive species. I also think that climate change is kind of blowing open that question, because so many people now are advocating for species or ecotypes of species that are evolved to handle drier or warmer temperatures being purposefully introduced to landscapes so that they will be able to survive in the future or be able to migrate. You know, the idea of human-assisted migration where land managers or volunteers would purposefully move species poleward in order to help them survive climate change. And that the group of people that believe that assisted migration is a good idea really hits against the group of people that are concerned about species nativity and the possibility of invasive species. And I find this, you know, one example that I use in teaching is that of a local example. I'm based in Bennington, Vermont, is that of the emerald ash borer. And I, you know, I'm really bummed out about the emerald ash borer, which is an introduced insect species that's has killed the ash trees on my property. And it makes me sad every time I look at them. And there are insects that are evolved to specifically live on ash trees. But the emerald ash borer has also led to a local boom in woodpecker species because these dead trees are providing great habitat for woodpeckers and other cavity dwellers. And so I use this example with my students to think about, you know, is the emerald ash borer purely an environmental agent of harm, or are there some benefits as well, at least at a temporary scale? And if you're concerned about populations of yellow-bellied sapsuckers, is it okay to keep the emerald ash borers, right?
Yeah, it's a very controversial subject for sure. You know, one of the chapters towards the end of your book that I also found fascinating was you talk about how ecological restoration has become big business in some respects. And you particularly, you started out by focusing on what Disney did in mm-hmm. Central Florida when they wanted to develop Disney World, I guess. Part of the deal was that they were going to, I guess, fill some wetlands, and they had to compensate by restoring nearby wetlands. And they did it on a pretty vast scale.
Yes, yeah, so I argue in the book that, so today I think, you know, a lot of listeners will be familiar with the idea of carbon offsets, or, you know, when you buy a plane ticket, for example, you often now will have the option of donating money to plant a tree or to otherwise try and capture greenhouse gases from the environment in compensation for taking that flight. And so this is the idea of compensatory mitigation or carbon offsetting is the idea of, you know, doing an environmentally beneficial project in one place in order to offset an environmental harm in another place. So maybe planting a tree in California in order to offset my flight from Boston to the UK, right? This idea of kind of restoring in a different place in order to compensate for a harm in a separate location is a really new concept. And I argue in the book that it emerges from this Disney example in the early 1990s and from wetlands mitigation, which under the Clean Water Act is not mandated, but it is allowed. A developer to go ahead with a project can compensate for wetlands damage by creating or restoring a wetland elsewhere. And it's this bureaucracy that and economy that evolves around wetlands trading in the early 1990s that leads to carbon trading today. And so I thought that was a really interesting, and it's we see this consolidation of restoration projects. So it's less often today do we see really small scale wetlands restoration projects. Instead, there are these mega projects in Florida, in Louisiana, in California, where wetlands banks consolidate the restoration projects that are required of dozens of different corporate developers. And we're seeing the same thing with carbon offsetting and the forest plantations that are being set up in typically in third world countries where there are these giant mega projects being set up. And I end the book arguing that restoration, one of the things that is so vital about restoration is that it has been local and small scale and democratic and various. Not every restoration project, just like every gardener designs a different garden, every restorationist designs a different project. And that diversity at a landscape level is really important. And I'm concerned that the kind of corporatization of restoration means that we're moving towards these really big mega projects where many fewer people have a voice in the project.
I think it's, you know, it's wonderful to me when you can bring the restoration into the human landscape. One of my favorite incidents in your book was when they were captive raising peregrine falcons and trying to reintroduce them to the East Coast. One of the places they released them was into Manhattan.
Yes.
Thinking that the skyscrapers were like the cliffs that they had, you know, ancestrally lived on. And they actually succeeded there.
Yes, they did. They were very successful there, and people spot, you know, there's still websites devoted to spotting the peregrines in New York. And yeah, I think, you know, it's something after having finished this book and you know, in my current research, I'm really interested in restoration in people's backyards and in urban environments, and blurring this very sharp divide that we have in the United States between conservation landscapes and everywhere else.